Hello, everybody. Bill Buckmaster with you back in the driver's seat after a very pleasant three-day weekend that we had, John Engineering and producing on the other side of the glass. And, of course, whenever we are off on Monday, well, today, Tuesday, feels like a Monday. Just one of those things. It's the 21st of February, 2023. Our show now in our 13th year broadcasting from the Green Things Zocalo Village Studios, the radio station 1030, Tucson's voice for trusted news talk. It's KVOI, worldwide live listening on my website, buckmastershow.com. Our live line for our telephone interviews presented by Rincon Ventures Real Estate and Property Management. Without further ado, we go now on the live line to the state capitol. State Senator Ken Bennett, one-time president of the Arizona Senate. He served as the 19th Secretary of State of Arizona from 2009 to 2015. He was a Republican candidate for Arizona governor in 2014 and 2018. And he was elected back to the Senate from District 1 last November. Ken Bennett, how does it feel to be back in the Senate?
Hey, you know, Bill, the bathrooms are in the same location, and they found me in office, so I'm in good shape.
There you go. How would you characterize this session so far, Ken?
Well, it's very nostalgic in the sense that when I became president of the Senate in 03, exactly 20 years ago, we had a brand new Democrat governor, Janet Napolitano, at the time. And so the idea of a Republican-controlled legislature, albeit slightly, one vote in each the House of the and the Senate, and a Democrat governor, it's like deja vu. We're back to a Republican legislature and a Democrat governor. And so it's feeling like good old times already.
Why did you and your colleagues send Governor Hobbs the so-called skinny budget, which she vetoed? It was a $15.1 billion basic budget plan that you and your colleagues passed. Why bother with that?
The Republican caucuses wanted to at least kind of put on the record that we had passed, I don't know that I would call it a skinny budget. Some people did call it that, but it was a continuation budget of all of the ongoing funding formulas that the governor and legislature, which included Democrats supporting the budget last year, plus formula increases in major state agencies like the K-12 school system, access, the indigent healthcare system, any formula growth that was projected for next year's budget was also added to it. So it's above the spending of last year. But I think it's fair to say, Bill, that the Republican caucuses in the House and the Senate wanted to kind of put on record that we had passed a budget that funds the basic elements of state government, continuing from this year into next year. Some people were saying that, you know, maybe the governor would sign it. I did not expect that. So it was more of a signal that, you know, we had passed a budget to keep state government open beginning July 1st when the fiscal year starts. But I and most others were expecting that Governor Hobbs would veto it. And now that she has, I think that's the signal back from her to us that we need to sit down and negotiate a bipartisan budget, because we're right back where we were 20 years ago, Republican legislature and Democrat governor. And when I was president of the Senate those 4 years with Janet Napolitano, one of the ways we made that work, at that time we had 17 Republicans in the Senate, 13 Democrats. Now we're 16, 14, so very close. But one of the things that we were able to make it work back then was I respected that she needed 9 or 10 of her 13 Democrats to support a budget or major pieces of legislation. She respected that I needed 13 or 14 of my 17 Republicans, and we might lose 2 or 3 on the far right, and we might lose 2 or 3 on the far left, and I don't like those labels necessarily, but the other 24 or 5 of us in the middle, and I don't like that label either, would get something done. And so This was a signal from the Republicans that we at least passed a budget that would continue state operations starting July 1st. She's vetoed it, so that's the signal back that we got to sit down and work together.
Is criminal justice a priority for Governor Hobbs, do you think?
I can't tell yet. You know, of our almost $16 billion state budget, I think you said 15.1, but I thought it was closer to 15.7. But I'm going to characterize it at about $16 billion. The state prison and court system and law enforcement and all of that is about $2.5 billion of that 16. So it's not, you know, by far the largest chunk of state government, but I didn't see any major statements or initiatives in her budget proposal that that made a big statement about that, about criminal justice. But I think she would agree to continue kind of at the current level and see if we can make that part of state government even better.
How about this budget, the state surplus? I think Governor Hobbs's team estimates it at about $1.3 billion. What does your math show, and what would you be comfortable with for a rainy day fund, Ken Bennett?
Well, to me, it's very important that ongoing spending, spending that we spend every year, is at least no more and maybe a little bit less than the ongoing revenue that comes in from tax collections. We do have $2 or $3 billion of monies left over, like COVID monies and other federal fundings and things like that. We've got a significant cash balance left over from the end of the previous fiscal year. But that doesn't repeat itself coming in the door next year necessarily. So one of the most important things to me 20 years ago with Napolitano and will be again now with Hobbs is that our ongoing spending programs, things that happen every year, should be equal or less than the ongoing revenue that comes in from tax collections. And the other end of year balances left over from last year, one-time money, we often call it, can be used for one-time expenses, roads or buildings or capital projects or you know, paying down debt or putting some more money in the rainy day fund. The rainy day fund right now is at $1.4 billion. So for a budget that spends about $16 billion a year, we have not quite 10% set aside for a rainy day. So I think we could use another small contribution to the rainy day fund so that the rainy day fund was kind of maybe in the 10% range. And I think, you know, your listeners can think in terms of, you know, if they lived on, I don't know what the household income might be, let's say $50,000 a year, then a 10% reserve would be like having $5,000 in your savings account. So that would at least give you a couple months of, you know, buffer in a worst case scenario. And so I think a 10% rainy day fund would be appropriate for the state. Right now, we're just a little bit slightly less than that.
Are we going all the way to July 1st with this session? Is this going to be one of those? You remember those where they stop the clock on June 30th, and it goes on and on into the first day of July. What's your take?
Well, we're probably headed there because it's been 16 years since Napolitano last was governor, maybe 15 or 14 or whatever the number is, that we had this kind of shared government. Some call it divided government. I prefer to call it shared government. And we are learning, both the legislature, controlled by Republicans, and the governor's office, a Democrat, we're learning that we've got to give a little. We don't have to give away our fundamental principles. You know, the governor talked about getting rid of the education scholarship accounts that give parents the right to choose where their children attend education. The Republicans are not going to give up on that. The governor has identified some priorities that are very important to her, like scholarships for Dreamers. That's typically not something, you know, most Republicans would embrace, but in this case, we might have to say that if we want to protect our top priorities, we're going to have to give her some of her top priorities.
Right.
We're going to probably agree to disagree on any changes in abortion or Second Amendment, you know, major changes in Second Amendment policies in the state and some other things. But she's certainly entitled as the governor to get some of her priorities, and we're entitled as the legislature to get some of ours. And
yep.
It's going to have to be a give and take. And if we start working in that mindset right now, we don't have to go right to, you know, July 1st and stop the clocks and do all that kind of garbage. But right now, we're not learning very quickly that we have shared government, and I hope we start learning that more quickly.
All right. Good catching up with you, Ken Bennett, State Senator. Thank you, Ken.
Thank you, Bill.
All right. This portion of our program is presented by our friends at Mona's Danish Bakery. We were up at Mona's over the weekend. Yes, I did do a cinnamon roll, and I had a really nice quiche. So a good meal that I could still, on the soft side, as I'm still nursing my little dental issue from about over a week and a half ago, but I'm kind of need to eat soft food for 2 weeks. So Mona's fit the bill. It will fit the bill for you. And one piece of advice I have, Mona's is so popular that, especially on weekends, I would suggest getting there early. They open Sunday, 7 a.m., Saturday, Tuesday through Saturday at 6:30 in the morning. So get there early. You'll have the widest variety of choices of those luscious bakery items. Websites, monasdanishbakery.com. Shelley Fishman is next. And if he had three thumbs, he would be giving me an enthusiastic three thumbs down. But what do you expect? The markets know. It's Shelley and Buckmaster, and it's a Tuesday. We'll be right back. Family-owned Jam Culinary Concepts and its family of restaurants has you covered for your special event. Jam caters anytime, anywhere, any size group, and any type of cuisine. Vero Amore, authentic Neapolitan pizza, and Noble Hops. Craft beer and fine fare are synonymous with quality. Call 954-1468 or log on to jamculinaryconcepts.com.
The Regional Transportation Authority's 20-year plan includes roadway, transit, pedestrian, bicycle, and many other transportation improvements across the region. Pima County voters approved the plan in 2006, and the RTA is working with the Citizens Advisory Committee to prepare and present a new draft plan as early as 2023 for public review. Learn more about the process at rtanext.com.
Buckmaster Show listeners know that I'm passionate about travel. When I'm ready to take off on a new adventure, my air travel begins and ends at Tucson International Airport. TUS is nonstop for our community and Southern Arizona. So remember, to fly local, fly Tucson. Tucson International is nonstop for Tucson. More at flytucson.com.
For more than a half century, Tucson Gardeners Trust Green Things, a family-owned and operated retail and wholesale plant nursery, offering an amazing variety of plants, trees, cacti, pottery, and so much more, all at great prices. The 13.5-acre site by the Rito River is also home to the Zocalo Village, specializing in fine Mexican and Latin American imported furniture and art. Green Things open daily at 3384 East River Road and at greenthingsaz.com and zocalovillage.com.
Are you happy with the news you get? While not all news is good news, you know good reporting when you see it. Check TucsonSentinel.com every day for breaking news and investigative reports. Have your say in the comments. It's all in TucsonSentinel.com, your local, independent, nonprofit news. You can rely on TucsonSentinel.com for solid reporting about immigration, Tucson and penal politics, everything from the border to baseball. It's independent news without the spin. TucsonSentinel.com. We are watching Tucson.
The nonprofit Tucson Wildlife Center has been helping injured, sick, and orphan wildlife in southern Arizona since 1999. They're dedicated to the rescue, medical care, and rehabilitation of sick, injured, and orphan wildlife, with the goal of releasing them back to their natural habitat. Around 5,000 animals a year come to them, as they are the only wildlife rescue in southern Arizona. All made possible through donations. They receive no government funding. Please donate at TucsonWildlife.com.
Shelley Fishman is a financial consultant in private practice in Tucson, Arizona. The views expressed during this segment are his own and don't necessarily represent those of this station or of Bill Buckmaster Communications. Contact Shelley through BuckmasterShow.com or at ShelleyFishman.com.
And here he is. Shelley, how's the week going so far?
It was better yesterday when the market was closed.
Yeah, wasn't that the truth?
Yeah, we're down about 2% across the board.
Writer Jeff Sommer, maybe he had a crystal ball or something, Shell. He was writing in the New York Times business section Sunday. The title of the piece was An Uneasy Dance Between the Fed, the Markets and the Fed. And I would call what's going on today uneasy.
Well, you know, I've got a better word for it.
Yes.
War.
War.
Okay, so what's going on here, Bill, is that this economy is not acting like economies are supposed to act, and we've talked about the laws of, you know, physics being broken by this economy with very, very low unemployment, very, very good consumer spending, some moderate growth quarter over quarter. And that shouldn't be happening at the same time the Fed is trying to kill inflation. Now, from the Fed's perspective, a good performance on the markets is a really bad thing, because when the markets are performing well, people feel rich and they spend money. Mm. And spending money makes inflation more difficult to control. So, you know, we've talked about this and talked about this and talked about this. You know, Summer gets it really right. If anybody wants to, you know, go to the New York Times site and take a look at a very easy to read, kind of, you know, maybe 500 words, 600 words, something like that. It really kind of puts it in perspective, and that's why I called it out.
Shelley, we don't think about it much as investors, but what goes on in the boardroom has a huge impact on not only investors, but the economy in general.
Absolutely. And what's going on in the boardrooms now is something that you and I have not really discussed. We think about corporations being owned by their stockholders.
Right.
But we rarely think about who those stockholders are,
mm-hmm.
and what influence they have, and what the ways may be that they exert that influence.
Mm-hmm.
More and more these days, stocks are held by investment companies. Yeah, there's a bunch of stocks that are held, you know, certainly through the brokerages for 401ks and individual investors. But to a very large extent, three big asset managers control $20 trillion in assets that cast a quarter of all votes among S&P 500 companies.
Wow.
Now, what does that mean?
That's huge influence in the boardroom.
So that says that if you're a CEO or a CFO or a member of the top strategic management team in a corporation, and you know that your stockholders can advance forward at your annual or quarterly stockholder meetings proposals that would affect your business that you might not necessarily agree with, then you scratch your head and say, wait a second, these people own us now, and we have to listen to them.
Mm-hmm.
And what's propelling these large groups of investors more and more are the issues that you and I have discussed that said that, you know, the old Milt Friedman 1970s idea that the chief and only job of a corporation is to make money,
mm-hmm.
that has now been set aside,
mm-hmm.
saying that you have a responsibility not only to your shareholders, but to the other stakeholders as well. And those stakeholders include, you know, stockholders, of course, but also employees and customers and suppliers, and interestingly, the community. And so when you, one of your more important stakeholders is the community, then how that community is reacting to current events and to how the society is changing becomes really very important. And the kind of a buzzword has begun to pop up, and it's called ESG. And ESG stands for the interests of, I want to get this right, the environment, the social and government standards. So when you are being influenced by people who are, and I'll use a word that I hate to use, but it's kind of a current buzz, woke, and those three standards are becoming more and more woke, if you will, more and
wokish.
More and more trying to balance the needs of what's going on in the society, what's going on in the environment, and what's going on through government regulation, then the ability of top managers to simply look at the bottom line becomes somewhat compromised. And there was an article in today's Washington Post by Duncan Maven that talks about how this culture war, and he calls it a culture war battle, that really might not have any winners. Because if you exert enough influence on corporations such that their short-term results become compromised, then you are also doing damage to the economy. And so both sides lose. The investment community loses, and ultimately the economy loses, because when corporations begin to lay people off, reduce their investing, or specifically target certain investments for reduction, and those investments could be in tobacco companies or Second Amendment rights companies or gasoline petroleum companies, then you wonder about what influence this wokeness, to use the right wing kind of term for it, will have, at least in the short and medium term, on the economy. Now, I believe what the Conference Board did a couple of years ago now, which is to recommend that these other stakeholders be kind of factored in to the decision-making in the boardroom to bring this, you know, kind of full circle, I think it's a good thing in the long term, because stronger communities, stronger customer groups, stronger supplier groups, these stakeholders can, in the long term, really determine the performance of corporations. But in the short or medium term, it might be a problem for the economy if the economy were, for instance, more fragile than it is right now. So it's something to keep an eye on. It's something
it's
I never
very,
really
very
thought
complicated.
Of.
You know, it's something we don't think about. And normally we just think about boards get together and say, hey, we need to make more money.
Well, and that was the kind of standard for 40 or 50 years. The standard now is we have to make more money, but we have to make more money not just for our owners, but for all of the groups that have a stake in our performance. And that means we have to make more money for our employees. We have to do better by those employees, especially in an economy where only maybe 10% of employers are unionized. Mm-hmm. So employee bargaining power is somewhat compromised. Now, with a 3.4% unemployment rate, you know, you could argue that employees now have a higher bargaining ability on an individual basis. But these are all, I think, really interesting. What's happening in this century is that the rules of the economy that we have, of macroeconomics, that we have kind of taken for granted and have become kind of instinctive for us, have all changed. And so we need to think differently about how the economy works and what's critical in that economy and what may not be critical in the economy. And that's what we're seeing more and more in the business press. And, you know, I think we'll talk more and more about this particular piece of it because it's changing the way companies do business.
I wish the Fed governors who have been going around making speeches would be a little more careful with their words, getting back to when the next Fed meeting is, I guess, mid-March, right?
Mid-March.
Okay.
And, you know, the bet is that they'll either do nothing this time or raise the rates 0.25%. If, on the other hand, they deem that inflation is still stubbornly too high.
Right.
They could go another 0.5%. Mm. And Bill, the market's not going to like that at all.
No, not at all. I think they thought 0.5% was in the rearview mirror.
Yeah, I hope.
But, hope so. Okay, Shell, thank you very much. Very thought-provoking and delving into an area we don't think too much about, the boardroom. Hope you have a great rest of the week.
You too, Bill.
All right, we'll take a break right here. Dr. Jeff Silvertooth, we're going to talk about the water situation in Arizona right after this.
Take out authentic Neapolitan wood-fired pizza at Vero Amore, where every flavorful pizza, pasta, and panini are homemade using the finest local and imported ingredients. Vero Amore, Plaza Palomino at Swan and Fort Lowell, and on Dove Mountain in Marana, plus a full catering menu and mobile pizza truck for parties and events. Vero Amore, on the web at veroamorepizza.com.
The Friends of Pima Animal Care Center is the nonprofit partner to our Pima County Animal Shelter. We grant critically needed resources to PACC so that it can continue the amazing life-saving progress it has made in recent years. Your generosity helps us find homes for abused, neglected, and abandoned animals at PAC. Learn how you can help at friendsofpacc.org.
As a small business owner, I appreciate the services of a top-notch certified public accountant. That's why Michael C. Flowers of Flowers, Rieger & Associates is the CPA firm of the Buckmaster Show. Michael's a former Small Business Leader of the Year in Tucson. He'll professionally handle all of your accounting needs and tax preparation services. Flowers, Rieger & Associates, 6125 East Grant Road, and on the web, flowersrieger.com.
Hi, this is Irene Coppola, President and CEO of the Better Business Bureau serving Southern Arizona. The BBB sets the standards for marketplace trust by engaging with and educating consumers and businesses. The BBB is the resource to turn to for the objective, unbiased information on businesses offering national and local consumer services online and in person. Learn more about the many services offered by the Better Business Bureau at bbb.org.
Cushman & Wakefield PICOR is Tucson's leading independently owned full-service commercial real estate company. Founded in 1985, Cushman & Wakefield PICOR offers leasing, sales, and property management for industrial, office, medical, retail, land, and investment properties in Tucson and Sonora, Mexico. Visit our website at PICOR.com for the latest news from Tucson's commercial real estate sector. That's PICOR.com. Call us at 748-7100.
Are you interested in sailing on an all-inclusive luxury cruise, trekking on an expedition adventure, or relaxing on a tropical beach? Then join us on February 26th at the Hilton El Conquistador as Bon Voyage Travel hosts our free travel showcase. Over 35 representatives from the world's best travel brands will be on hand to help you discover all the world has to offer. The Bon Voyage Travel Showcase, February 26th. Be sure to visit bvtravel.com for more information.
Welcome back. It is the Buckmaster Show in the Green Things Zocalo Village Studios, Green Things, 3384 East River Road. What an incredible selection they have of just about everything you could imagine for the garden. 13-acre site, also home to Zocalo Village, beautiful merchandise, much of it imported from Mexico. They have really a new shipment, I'm told, of talavera and some beautiful pottery up from Mexico, so you might want to check it out. Green Things open daily. They're in their 53rd year. Green Things open daily. Their website, greenthingsaz.com and zocalovillage.com. Our live line presented by Rincon Ventures, Real Estate and Property Management. With me in studio for his monthly appearance on our program, Dr. Jeff Silvertooth, professor and extension specialist in agronomy and soil science in the Department of Environmental Science at the University of Arizona. Jeff has served on the University of Arizona faculty and worked statewide since 1987. He is recognized as a fellow for both the American Society of Agronomy and Soil Science Society of America. Jeff, how are you?
Very good, Bill. Thank you.
How is your new year going so far?
Very good so far, thankfully.
What is the difference between agronomy and soil science, just briefly, to kind of give the viewers just kind of the 30,000 view of the thing?
Right. It's simple. Agronomy is a study of the science of crop and soil science, plant and soil science. And so each of us, as you get more advanced in that arena, go into a specialization of either soil science of some sort, and there are many parts of soil science, or plant sciences. And I have specialized in soil fertility, plant nutrition. So it's a blend of plant and soil science. So it's right down the middle of agronomy. And I work with crop production in the field. So that's what an agronomist is a crop and soil scientist.
Well, Jeff, the number one issue, and this should not come to a surprise to certainly our listeners, because every time you're on this show, we've been talking recently about water. And
right.
The voters of Arizona, according to recent polling, nearly 70%, Jeff, said there's no question about it. The number one issue right now facing Arizona is water and water conservation and what we're going to do about sustainable futures.
I'm glad to hear that.
Yep.
I'm very glad to hear that as an educator.
So the message is getting through.
Yes, yes, yep. It has. And I have worked with many journalists in the past, really 6 months to a year, but truly it's been quite accentuated in the past 6 months, since last June.
Yes.
Almost 9 months now. And they've been doing a good job of beating that drum, getting it out of it, but it's real. And that's an important point. Sometimes people think, well, is this just hype in the news? Is this just an accentuation of a little problem? But I can assure you it's real, and it's good for us as desert dwellers. We need to be conscious of that, in my view. That's the number one thing we need to live in this desert is water.
And we hold out, many of us have been holding out hope for some kind of a desal program coming up, pipeline from Mexico. But the governor of Sonora, when he met with some advisors from this Israeli group that had proposed this pipeline, the governor of Sonora said, not on my watch.
Well, that's a good example right there. I mean, you can see we can draw something out on paper.
Mm-hmm.
And we can even take some additional steps as far as feasibility studies. But there's a lot of parts to put together.
Yeah.
And that's really emblematic of what we're dealing with in this water situation out here. The Colorado River is probably most emblematic of that. I mean, you can go in any county in the state of Arizona, and we can then identify and discuss what are the serious water issues in each of those parts of the state. The Colorado River is emblematic of that because you have seven states involved in the United States, two states in Mexico, so you have international relations as well. And, of course, 30 American Indian tribes, about 40 million people, 6 million acres of cropland. Anything you do is going to be touching in to try to solve our problem is going to touching in on someone else. And so it's a complex deal to work the balance out. And the deal in Sonora with the desal plant's a classic example of that. You know, you can get the Israelis lined up, get some people thinking, well, let's take and pursue this, but we've got to have an agreement from the Mexican government. And not only the state of Sonora, but it'll be Baja California probably as well. They're going to want some of that water, I bet. And water is controlled in Mexico by an organization called CONAGUA, and it's a national organization. So the Mexicans will have to deal with that as well. And that's just business, dealing with international order.
And California has really, they're the kind of the big, the gorilla in the room, Jeff Silvertooth. And since you visited with us last in January, they've made it pretty apparent that they're not about to cut much of their water supply right now.
Well, this
and they've been even
point.
Making overtures about, well, Arizona and the CAP and on and on and mm-hmm. on, like mm-hmm. they're not even happy with that at all.
Right. Well, yeah. You know, it's a rich history uh-huh. on this river, and the history of Arizona and California goes back to the 150 years ago, you know, just dividing water out on the river. And it certainly began with the Colorado River Compact in 1922. And that was further been solidified with the Boulder Canyon Act. And then there was a major case, or several things that have gone under this law of the river, but a case of Arizona versus California that was filed in 1953 and settled 1952, settled in 1963. And not being an attorney, but just looking at what you just stated in terms of where we are today, there was a long line tracing back to the relationships of Arizona and California. And California was allocated that water, and they ratified that through the laws, what's collectively referred to as the law of the river, and that's what they're referring back to today. Mm-hmm. They're saying in this state of crisis, we'll follow the law. Well, the law pretty well says California mm-hmm. is the last to give up, yeah. and they still keep their 27% of the water on the Colorado River, which is 4.4 million acres out of 16.5 we have allocated. So they are the big player in mm-hmm. the room. They get mm-hmm. the lion's share, followed by Colorado at 23% and then Arizona at 17%. So California is saying right now, and I think any of us, honestly, if we look at it and objectively put ourselves in their shoes and say, follow the law of the river. It's been 100 years in the making. We've agreed to it before. It's been ratified in the courts, went to the Supreme Court in that Arizona-California case in 1963, and that's their position. Now, the other side is saying there's a six-basin proposal that's in there as well that was submitted to the Department of Interior, Bureau of Reclamation. That was by an Arizona joined that with the other five basin states. And that basically is saying it's got a different plan and it has a different way of looking at it. It's basically saying California needs to take a larger share of the cut because they get a larger share of the water on the river, and we need to do this somewhat proportionally. That's a simple way of putting it. But, you know, a lot of folks are upset by the fact, like you say, that we have this kind of controversial split in those two proposals. I look at it as I'm one of the few maybe that does. I think it's good we have two proposals. Mm-hmm. Two proposals that have come in, and they're highlighting the positions that are pretty well exemplary of these two, you know, groups on the river, California and the six other basin states. And that's amazing they came to agreement. But the Bureau and the Department of Interior has two proposals to review. And they've got a tight needle to thread for themselves. But it has a long history, Bill, you know, in this water deal and where we are today. I've been having I'm not an attorney. I'm mm-hmm. not a water policy right. expert. You know, I'm an agronomist, as we
sure.
started out.
Yeah, yeah.
It's good that you defined that.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm a student of this, and then looking into it, I realized, wow, it is complex.
Yeah. We had Congressman Grijalva on our Friday Focus interview a couple of Fridays back. And as you know, Jeff, he is the chair of the very powerful Natural Resources mm-hmm. Committee. And he was talking about how, even on his own committee, how it's weighted toward Californians. And they really, really are pretty hardcore about this water issue.
Yes, they are.
Yeah.
Yes, they are. And you can see why.
Yeah.
You know, with the population that they have and, mm-hmm. and the uses they have of that water. It's interesting to me how well California has come together. The ag, metro sections, which are usually at opposition. There's struggles among them as well. But it's impressive to me how well the California entities have coalesced and formed a unified front on this case, from what I can see. Actually, I'm leaving this afternoon, traveling to Yuma. We're conducting the Southwest Ag Summit this week in Yuma. It's a large conference for this part of the world, agricultural conference. And we'll be out there on Thursday for the conference, and I have a session dealing with the Colorado River water shortage, agricultural perspectives. And we'll have representation from the irrigation districts in Colorado, in California, and in Arizona. So that should be an interesting portrayal of that.
Let's see if we can work in caller David. He always loves to comment on water. David, you're with Jeff Silvertooth. Go ahead, please.
Yes, this is a new issue I found out. The federal government is using our tax dollars to chain and masticate the pinyon and juniper woodlands on our federal lands in the West, mainly Utah. And they're doing it. They're increasing the scale of these projects to massive, like 20,000 acre areas. They're doing it, and when they do it on this scale, it disturbs the land and it creates dust, which is carried by the wind and deposits on the snowpack, which feeds the Colorado River, and it causes the snowpack to melt faster because the dust will absorb the sun's heat and cause it to melt faster. We lose that snowpack and that storage capacity.
Mm-hmm.
And also, the bad thing of doing this is we got the buffalo grass infestation down here because we introduced this invasive grass. Well, when they remove the native pinyon juniper woodlands, which don't tend to burn too much, what replaces them are invasive grasses that burn and create these terrible wildfires. So this federal program not only is impairing our storage capacity of the Colorado River, but it's creating conditions for a worse wildfire. And I want to get this word out to everybody listening. Please call your congressman to get this stopped, because this chaining and masticating of our pinyon juniper woodlands is impairing the storage capacity of the Colorado River watershed.
Okay. A little bit different perspective there, Jeff.
Well, those are good points, David.
Yeah.
And those are points that program you're describing, that I believe it's a thinning program on the pinyon.
It is, yeah.
Pinyon juniper, the way we call the PJ woodlands.
It hasn't gotten a lot of publicity, that's for sure.
Not just in a general section.
Yeah.
I mean, in the agriculture community, in the range community, it has, because it affects a lot of folks, of course, that have federal land leases, either through BLM, Bureau of Land Management, or the Forest Service.
Mm-hmm.
So with regard to your comments, David, your points are well taken. And I would suggest too, as you have advocated to the listeners with us today, it's not only just contacting your congressman, but specifically, I think those are actions and policies associated with the Forest Service and the Bureau of Land Management. They probably have a rationale behind that, and I have colleagues that I work with that are in range management, forest management, and there's a logic they have with that. Of course, it's like a lot of big projects; they aren't perfect; they have imperfections. But your points are well taken with regard to the multifaceted aspects of our ecosystems. And as we try to manage ecosystems, you know, it's kind of like the waterbed effect, as I sometimes put. You push on one part, and there's another part. To try to solve one part of a problem, you sometimes exacerbate others. So your points well taken, David. Thank you.
All right, we'll take a break right here. When we come back, the latest on the levels of Lake Mead and Lake Powell. The news is not good in that area. Jeff Silvertooth with me for another segment. Be right back.
Tucson's original gastropub, Noble Hops in Oro Valley, proudly announces a second Tucson area location where you'll enjoy locally brewed craft beer and gastropub fine fare. Order in or take out at Noble Hops, a pub for foodies, on West Lambert Lane at North La Cañada Drive in Oro Valley, and now at the Doubletree Hotel on Alvernon across from Tucson's Reed Park. More on the web at noblehops.com.
At Tucson International Airport, we are nonstop for our community. Our main priorities are providing a safe and secure travel experience and excellent customer service. We're also nonstop for landing prosperity in Southern Arizona by attracting new flights for business travel and family getaways. When your airport thrives, our community thrives. So fly local, fly TUS. Tucson International Airport is nonstop for Tucson.
The Regional Transportation Authority plan is funded by a voter-approved half-cent sales tax. The RTA tax is collected throughout Pima County and averages about $100 million in revenue each month. The RTA is the largest annual funder of regional transportation projects in the region. The RTA tax funds priority projects that were approved by voters in 2006. See details in the latest RTA annual report at rtamobility.com.
This is Bill Buckmaster urging my listeners to join me in becoming a member of the Reed Park Zoo, one of America's top zoos and home to more than 300 animals from all over the world. When you become a zoo member, you receive free daytime admission, discounts on special events and education programs, and so much more. Find out more about zoo membership and everything you need to know about your zoo visit, reedparkzoo.org.
Nestled in the foothills of the Santa Rita Mountains of southeastern Arizona is Equine Voices and Sanctuary. Home to horses and burros that were rescued from neglect, abuse, abandonment, and slaughter. Please consider Equine Voices Rescue and Sanctuary with a financial gift of support and estate remembrance. Learn more about our vision and values at equinevoices.org.
The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun cover two of Arizona's most desirable communities. The newspapers reach more than 75% of the communities each week, with a combined population of more than 50,000. The Green Valley News also publishes a dozen magazines each year, and both newspapers publish up-to-the-minute local news online at gvnews.com. The Green Valley News and Sarita Sun, it's all right here.
Family-owned and run since 1985, Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing is the gold standard for quality and professionalism for picture framing, custom frame mirrors, art for your walls, and hanging and lighting solutions. Come in for your design session or set it up electronically. Moe's Gallery and Fine Framing, Fort Lowell and Dodge, and now doing e-commerce at moesgallery.com.
Welcome back. It is the Buckmaster Show in the Green Things Zocalo Village Studios. Got a pretty good thunderstorm here at the KVOI Green Things Zocalo Village Studios. The Buckmaster Show, one of our great sponsors, Silver City in Grant County, New Mexico. Start planning your spring getaway. Perfect time of year over there in March. Maybe the kids are off. Little spring break time, only about a three-hour drive to Silver City and Grant County. Start your planning by visiting southwestnewmexico.org. Find out about all the great outdoor activities and places to stay, some great places to dine as well. Jeff Silvertooth, University of Arizona agronomist, who will be very much involved with the Southwest Ag Summit, which is a really big deal. Later this week over in Yuma. During the break, you were telling me that conflicts between Arizona and California over water are not new. I mean, you were telling me about an incident where the National Guard of Arizona almost came to blows, shots fired with the California authorities over water. I think that was in 1934. So,
That's right.
The history has been very checkered.
It has, indeed. That's a good example of it. That was when Arizona National Guard went over there and commandeered a ferry boat called the Julia B. They didn't have a bridge across the river at Parker at the time. They commandeered the boat and headed over to the dam site, dam construction site on the Julia B, and it was donned, I think, by a Los Angeles Times journalist who was there covering this event as the Arizona Navy. So that's always that's been our Arizona Navy legacy, was the Julia B with the National Guard out there.
So we've got the crisis concerning the massive reservoir at Lake Powell and Lake Mead at historic levels. There may be some relief with snowpack, but it won't be a lot of relief, will it?
Not a lot. Not enough. We need like several decades of high return flow into those reservoirs. We've had two decades to deplete them, and we're way behind on that. But, yeah, the snowpack looks good right now. And it kind of goes back to David's point in terms of, you know, the problems that we've had or we've experienced with the good snowpack that's accumulated several times in the past five, mm-hmm. 6 years that doesn't return to liquid water very well to the river because of warming conditions usually and higher evaporation, more vapor loss off the snowpack. Also, too, the forest right there in place that those snowpacks reside in and then melt through, they're the first crop to take their drink of water. And
yeah,
that's one of the reasons the Forest Service has been working to thin trees in the forest and woodlands, mm-hmm. also for fire reduction, fire potential. But they're the first ones to get the drink. So by the time we get the water and liquid water in the river, we've had significantly reduced return flows.
Jeff, and to give our listeners perspective, in the year 2000, the two reservoirs, Lake Powell and Lake Mead, were 95% full. Today, they're about 25% full.
Yeah. Right.
That's like less than 25 years.
Yeah, less than maybe about two decades it took to do that. And it's drawn us down. They're actually below 25% right now, both reservoirs. So really all this stuff that's pending with the Bureau of Reclamation, Department of Interior, the proposals from the two groups in the basin states is serious, and it needs to be acted upon right away. We have, just to let everybody know, too, there have been actions taken over the course of the past 20 years, a series of actions, but they just haven't been enough to solve our problem. And the problems actually worsen, as you just described, with the dropping levels of the reservoirs and increasing in temperatures and the lack of return flow. So all the steps that have been taken, about four or five major steps have been taken, you know, collectively across the basin to arrest the decline of the reservoirs, but it hasn't been enough. So where we are right now is very important for us all.
Soon, let's hope it's not soon, but the two hydroelectric turbines, the tubes that run mm-hmm. water out of the lake, out of Lake Powell, if they go below the tubes, then you're not going to be able to generate electricity. That's
right.
A really critical area.
Both points, both dams, particularly Powell. They put those in a little higher than they did at Boulder Dam. It's an interesting engineering deal. But they call those the penstocks, that the inlets, the intakes to the penstocks that turn to turbines.
Mm-hmm.
And they can't drop below that critical level because you don't want a cavitation to take place in those turbines because it can destroy them. You know, there's just a physical disruption of the cavitation. So that's a very important part, not only to maintain our reservoirs for water supply, but also for hydroelectric power generation, both with Powell and Meade.
The Department of Interior presumably would be required reductions in use before the doomsday scenario ever took effect, I think, right?
Yeah, I think so, too. I certainly hope so.
Yeah.
It's like saying when you jump out of a plane, I hope you pull the ripcord, you know. And it's the same thing here. We have to act on it. The question is how and how much. And it's like to say, I don't mean to be too redundant, but just to emphasize the point. It's a complex issue for the Bureau to work through and for everyone to work through.
So
but something has to be done.
Jeff, the Bureau, you say, has these two proposals.
Yes, sir.
When do you think we'll have some kind of definitive idea which one will be going forward?
A good question.
Yeah.
All right, what we've heard from the Interior and from the Bureau is that we'll probably get a response from them in March
mm-hmm.
from these two proposals and see preliminary, at least a response, and then probably see their decisions on actions in the summertime. Usually they come out with what they call the operational plan for the Colorado River system, both how mm-hmm. releases from Powell and releases from Meade and how they're going to manage that for the year in August. And they do that based on anticipation of water levels at Lake Meade in August. And so right now they run to a bunch of models and projections on that. Right now the model, I think the projections are, Bill, for the projections are for 2023, the end of 2023, for the river, the water levels in Lake Meade to be down around 1,020, 21 feet. That would put us at the bottom, at the maximum of what the drought contingency plan would be, tier 3 reductions. And we need more than that. But that tells you how serious this is.
Wow.
Yeah.
Okay. You'll be taking off for Yuma here for the Southwest Ag Summit. What bottom line, Jeff Silvertooth, what will you be hearing from your colleagues?
Well, what I'm doing is conducting a breakout session with the conference, focusing on the session's titled Colorado River Water Shortage, Agriculture Perspectives. And we have three other speakers. And one was a gentleman from Palo Verde Valley. He's a director, the district president. He's on the governing board for the Colorado River, representing the state of Colorado. We have a farmer from the Imperial Valley. When the Imperial Valley has 3.1 million acre feet, the largest single allocation of water on the river, and it's a huge agricultural valley. And, of course, a big target is on those folks out there. And then a gentleman who's the district manager in one of the Yuma area districts. These are very knowledgeable people. So their perspectives is what we'll be hearing, Bill.
All right, Jeff Silvertooth, it's always a pleasure. We'll look forward to your visit in March. This news just keeps happening so fast. I'm sure we'll have a ton of things to talk about and update our listeners in about 30 days.
Yes, we will.
Drive safely. Be careful, Jeff. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you.
All right, that'll do it. On behalf of Dr. Silvertooth and John Engineering and producing the show, Bill Buckmaster saying thank you very much for listening. Back with you in about 23 hours, and we'll do it all over. Have a great day.